Welcome to Business Game Changers, where you'll hear expert tips on the big issues and the hottest trends to level up your business game. If you're building a career or building a business, this is Must Hear Radio. Here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. This is Sarah Westall. Have you thought about leaving the country and finding better or cheaper healthcare? Well, I know I've thought about it. I haven't acted on it, but if I or one of my family members were very ill with a disease or something where another country had a more cutting edge treatment or had a lot better results than we have here, I don't think I'd even hesitate for a minute to leave to find better health care for my child if I thought they had a chance of dying. So there are a lot of people that are looking around for better health care options and are actually leaving the country and finding different solutions. You know what? It's obvious that there's a couple different reasons that people will be doing it, but for economic reasons, sometimes, you know, the wealthy have the resources to go find the best healthcare, and people who don't have as much money might leave the country to save a lot of money because it's more expensive here. Well, today we talk all about that. Dr. David Vequist joins us, and he is the founder and the director of the Center for Medical Tourism, which is located in the HEB School of Business and Administration at the University of the Incarnate Word of San Antonio, Texas. And he's going to be sharing the latest statistics and research on the subject. He has a ton of information. He shares this information with United Nations and talks to different world leaders and Congress and different people. They're a really good source of this information, and I just think it's better to know what's going on and face reality than to put your head in a hole and not learn what's going on. You can improve your environment by understanding what the issues are, and understanding the issues it's not bad to bring up a fact. You know, sitting around and complaining about something isn't a good thing. But if you bring up facts and trying to understand the current issues, that's how you go about solving problems. And I think that's what the center does and what Dr. David Vequist is all about. But before we get into that, we talk again with Tom Shepard, who's the founder and CEO of Shepard Financial. And he wraps up his describing the seven natures. And it'll set it up for next week, where we're going to go into a much longer discussion about our natures and how we can begin to use those to evolve our relationships. So now let's welcome Tom Shepard to the program. Hi, Tom. Welcome back to the program.
Hi, good to be here again.
I think there's only two left, lever and give, right?
Yeah, lever and give are the six and seventh relationships that people can have with money. The lever relationship comes from, if I have invested my money and I've got a second income coming in, what do I do with it? And the goal there would be to do one of two things: make even more money or pay down some stuff so that the difference between the income you have coming in and the income that's going out gets greater and greater and greater. So that's the lever. That's the leverage. Think of a wedge going in and creating separation.
Okay.
The giver, when you have done that often enough, you reach a certain point where the second income coming in is more than you need to spend. And so you have extra. You have this abundant amount of income, or in the case of energy or time, you've just got this extra stuff, and that's out of that abundance that you now can give to other things that maybe you feel inspired to give to.
Now, do people give when they don't have the ability to?
There have been many people who we have had to kind of sit down with them and say, look, you know, giving has a dark side, and it's called martyrdom. Leverage has a dark side. You know, that's being over-levered. Investing has a dark side. That's called speculation. Even saving has a dark side. It's called hoarding. And so every single one of these natures has positive and negative aspects of it. And we have run into people who have been successful no matter what their nature is, but we've run into people who have issues because they don't know what their nature is and they've been overcome by it.
Interesting. So it's really important as a basic element to understand what your natural tendencies are in order to be able to take that to the next level and start to, it's basically evolve with your money. Start to use the nature of money to, or the your nature to get money to work for you.
Yeah, but the natures give us an opportunity to help you define in words how to talk to yourself and use words to describe not only where you are, but where you ultimately want to go to and the different things that you have to do to get there. So, you know, in financial planning terms, that's how we can talk about it using money, but we can also help people realize that money is something that they can use to improve their relationships, to improve their time management skills, to even improve their health. Because if you're good at one of those other things, then you can get better at it with money and the other currencies. And then they just, all of them start to build on top of each other. And that just gets really inspiring and energizing.
Interesting. Okay, so now you're going to come back next week and you're going to start talking about how to utilize these natural states to start getting money to work for us.
Yeah, our ultimate goal is to start looking at some specific issues or examples where we've helped people to do this. And from that, I think it becomes a lot more clear, less theoretical and a lot more practical.
And that's good. That's what people want is how do I use this to just make more money? We're all looking for an answer to just have more with what we have, with the resources are always so limited around us. Well, thank you so much, Tom.
You're welcome.
Tom is always interesting to talk to. Be sure to tune in next week where we get a much deeper understanding of how to use these natures to evolve with our money. And you can also find his website and how to contact him on my webpage at sarahwestall.com. Now we're going to welcome Dr. David Vequist to the program to share all his information on medical tourism. Hi, David. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You have a statistic in a presentation that you gave that says in 2009, there were over 1.2 million Americans leaving the country to get medical care. Is this because of lower costs or treatments that are not available in the United States?
Well, that's a great question because it's a common question that a lot of people have as they say, is this a failure of the U.S. system? Is this the increasing complexity or increasing competence of the international providers? And quite frankly, it's a little bit of everything. The reason that people are leaving depends on the specific procedure that they happen to be leaving for. The most common procedure that people around the world travel for, including Americans, is dental. And so in the case of dental, quite frankly, it's probably cost. Now, this is makes up, again, at least a third of all medical travel based on several studies that have been done. So we can argue that cost is one of the major reasons. Then in terms of treatments either not being accessible or potentially quality, Americans seeking quality abroad, those are two other categories that people are seeking. The answer, though, I think was summarized by a Harvard business professor, Michael Porter, who suggested that in the United States we need to change the discussion of healthcare not around price or around quality, but around value, which is the perception of the consumer that there is both a good price for a good quality.
Right. It's where the curves cross, right? I mean, where you're going to pay for the quality.
Exactly right. And so that's, for example, with the dentist, let's say a dentist in Mexico, I think that most Americans perceive that the quality of a dentist in Mexico is not that different than the quality of a dentist in the United States. So therefore, when it comes to travel, even though Americans tend to be fairly provincial, in other words, that they typically aren't willing to travel outside of their borders for health care because they believe that American providers tend to be better than other international providers. In the case of dentists, I suspect that the perception is that there's not much difference, and so therefore, because there's a bigger difference in price, they're willing to travel.
Well, and dental, isn't it? A lot of that's just because they don't have insurance. The insurance programs for dental care really aren't insurance. You're going to be paying yearly. What about you're going to be paying in dental care anyways? And so a lot of people don't see that as a benefit. And so they have to pretty much pay for their own dental care. And so now that people are paying for their own dental care, they're shopping for the value. And when you add in travel costs and you take account value, it's less expensive for relatively the same value in Mexico.
And that's correct.
Yes.
That's correct. And here's the fascinating thing, and I know that I'll probably talk about this a little bit later too. I did a report for the UN. The United Nations was interested in how the PPACA or ACA or Obamacare would affect potential international travel from outside the United States into particularly Latin countries in South America, in Central America. And what we found is with the ACA, as you're seeing now over the last couple of years, is there's typically for the people in lower socioeconomic status, they're gaining access to these bronze plans in the ACA. They have high deductibles. They have deductibles of, say, upwards of $6,000. Well, that's essentially saying to that person that you have to pay out of pocket anyways for your care. So if you are a recent immigrant into the United States that is eligible for ACA, and you know people in a foreign country, say in Mexico, that where you know you can get a provider that will provide care for less than $6,000 for a particular medical procedure, you might as well just go down there rather than access a provider here in the United States. So you're absolutely right. It's patient consumerism, it's shopping, it's all the things that have happened in pretty much every other industry just happening to happen in healthcare in the United States.
Well, and dental makes a lot of sense because dental work can get pretty expensive, right? I mean, dental work, it is a health concern. And if you have an infection in your mouth or something that's very serious, it can get very expensive. And so, I can see why people do that. But you've calculated that $1.6 billion a year leaves the United States and goes elsewhere for medical care. But that number was based on 2009 numbers. I imagine, 6 years has gone by or 5 years have gone by. How high do you think that is today?
I think it's continuing to increase. If for no other reason, quite frankly, than regression to the mean. And what I mean by that is if you look at benchmarks internationally of the number of people that travel either domestically or internationally for healthcare in other regions being, for example, Europe or Asia or even Latin America, what you find is that most people, or even the Canadians, for example, most populations travel outside of their country more frequently than Americans do for their healthcare. Now, one reason for that is, again, the provincial cultural attitudes that we have in the United States. For example, about half of the population, I think it was less than half of the population, had passports in the United States. And so we have a very small percentage of the population in the U.S. that is able to or interested in traveling internationally. And then, obviously, the what we're seeing is, particularly with the healthcare environment changing in the United States, that people, and particularly the information that's available through the internet, people are finding that there is a variety of great providers all around the world. And so now they're being able to, as you point out, patient consumers being able to shop for healthcare on the internet and find what they need. And it may not always be where you live. It may be outside your county. It may be outside your state. It may be outside your country.
Well, and if you have a major situation, like you have cancer or you have a life-threatening illness, anybody, I mean, you would think that you would be willing, or more educated people, I would think, I shouldn't even say educated. I would think anybody that's more adventurous, it's not even the education thing, would be willing to go outside the United States to solve a life-threatening type problem.
Yeah, I agree. It's still going to be capped at a percentage. There was a wonderful piece done by Deloitte and Touche a couple of years back. Deloitte had categorized various healthcare consumers into categories, and they found out that there's probably three of these categorizations that are more likely to travel either domestically or internationally for healthcare. And if you look at those three categorizations, they still make up a minority of the total healthcare consumers in the United States. So quite frankly, the number of people that are willing to travel for healthcare internationally, or even, let's say, outside their state, is probably capped at, say, around 20 or less than 20%. So it's still going to be, a minority of Americans, but it is an increasing number every day as we become more like, Europeans and Asians. Gallup, a few years back, had looked at Asian populations, and they found that about 25%, this is a survey of 14 different countries in Asia, about 25% of the Asian populations traveled domestically for healthcare, meaning they traveled within their country. And if you're in China, and let's say you're in the western part of China, which tends to be very rural, to get access to good healthcare within your country, you'd have to travel to places like Beijing or Shanghai or some of the bigger cities. If you wanted to get perhaps even better healthcare, then you can travel outside of your country to go to places like Korea or Japan or Taiwan or even the United States. So there's we're becoming perhaps more like Europe. In Europe, it's about 4%, as measured a few years back, of the population that was traveling outside their country boundaries for healthcare. But quite frankly, that's probably gone up because the European Union passed something called the Cross-Border Initiative, Cross-Border Health Initiative, which allows European country citizens to be able to travel within the EU countries to receive healthcare. So we expect that's gone up. And I suspect that Americans traveling internationally has gone up. It's a much more competitive environment.
Well, and isn't it a lot of it because as people start learning what treatments are available on the internet and, well, pretty much the internet, I would think, there's so much more access to information, and people are starting to learn that the United States is not leading in every category of health. I mean, it's just not possible. And people with the resources want to go to the best place in the world to solve a life-threatening problem.
That's exactly right. That was the point I was just about to make, is we've seen high-level athletes, people like Peyton Manning of the Denver Broncos, Kobe Bryant of the Los Angeles Lakers, A-Rod of the New York Yankees, people that make massive amounts of money, and they or their teams can afford to pay for the best care in the United States, yet they have gone to providers in Germany, for example. We've seen athletes in the last couple of years that are prepared to go to Qatar or Switzerland. And the reason is that when you have means, what you look for is the best that you can possibly receive. And again, the world's a big place, and the best is not always in the United States. Now, what's interesting is there are some policy or regulatory aspects of the United States that are actually lending itself to that. For example, it's very common for people that want to get access to the newest pharmaceuticals or medical devices, that they have to go outside the United States. And that's because, for example, the FDA process in the United States for biomedical, for pharmaceuticals, takes upwards of 10 years to receive approval to get a new device.
Well, FDA is a little bit skewed to certain types of companies get the approval and other ones don't. And so there can be really more revolutionary ideas that certain companies have, but they just don't have a chance to get it past the FDA system. But in other countries, you're able to use these different procedures that are having really great results.
That is true. We do know, we have some historical examples of that. For example, one of the classic examples, models of this, was Lasix was available outside the United States before it became into the U.S. So we actually had international providers that were actually considered experts on Lasix before it ever came in the United States. So,
and that's true. My sister actually went and got Lasix surgery done in Canada before it came to the United States, or actually it was here in the United States, but she still went to Canada. Her husband's a Canadian citizen, but she went to Canada to get her eye surgery done because they had more advanced technology there. They were much more advanced than we were here.
That's correct. I just heard a case recently of a person that had been flying down to Panama to access a stem cell therapy that was originally being experimented with here in the United States, but due to the FDA cracking down on stem cell treatments, physician in the U.S. had to move their research practice down to Panama, where they had a more inclusive regulatory environment. So they were able to get access to, the person could only get access to that by going to Panama. I also heard a case a couple years back about a family that contacted a medical tourism facilitator that was trying to get access to a specific drug, as I recall, for treatment of multiple sclerosis that was available in Japan, but not available in the United States because the FDA hadn't approved it yet. And it was available in Japan, so all they had to do was basically contact a Japanese physician to be able to write a script for that, and then it was probably sent by FedEx to the United States, which is not necessarily a legal way to do it. It's a kind of a gray market solution to get access to a drug that is not currently prescribed in the United States, but it was a treatment that had some efficacy and some data behind it for treatment. So it's pretty fascinating. Now, you want to know the interesting controversial aspects of this. This is fascinating. Your listeners will love this. Because of the FDA's focus on arguably safety and security of Americans and trying to make sure that these devices and these pharmaceuticals, you know, don't cause anybody to, you know, grow a third nipple or to have purple hair or something of that nature. And other possibilities. What has happened is the regulatory or business environment in other countries, for example, in India, are a little more loosey-goosey. Well, that's fascinating because what we're seeing is the development of drugs and other types of biomedical procedures that are being confirmed and allowed internationally years. I mean, in India, you could potentially get a drug to market and is as little as 2 to 3 years, whereas it would take 10 in the U.S. So arguably, for about 7 years, you could potentially have access to something in India prior to it coming to the U.S. I read a case about as I recall, it was a Swiss biomedical company that had this brand new medicated stent that was made of a innovative material that what it could do is if it was clogged up and then fixed, it could actually pop back in place. It was this, again, revolutionary new medicated stent, and the company put out a little report about where it was going to be available, and they decided not to pursue the FDA approval process because not only would it take a long time and the cost involved, but also then the liability risk. We are a very litigious society in the United States, and healthcare is one of the most highly fought
yes,
areas.
Exactly. Lots of legal stuff going on in the healthcare industry.
Exactly. So they decided not to bring their stent to the United States, which is fascinating because if you look at the medicated stent environment, as I recall, and based on these numbers, when I looked at this article, I want to say it was close to 50% of all medicated stents are actually are performed in the United States, those procedures using medicated stents. So they were actually ignoring 50% of the market simply because they felt it would be a low margin, low profit market due to, again, liability and the fact that it would take years before they could get approval in the United States.
So a lot of innovative drugs and innovative solutions for healthcare problems are happening in other countries, and then our citizens aren't getting access to it because of the cost to bring it to market here and the government regulations.
Possibly. And again, we don't have an exact estimate of how many of these innovative solutions are available, but the data and the information points to it. And there are some examples of this. The best way that consumers can find out is obviously, as you discussed earlier, is through the internet. The internet is the great equalizer and bringing data and information and transparency to some extent, to the people that allows them to be better consumers of healthcare.
How much do the pharmaceutical companies or the FDA suppress solutions because they know that the American people aren't going to go elsewhere? They have a locked audience of eight, like you said, it's capped. 80% of the people are not going to leave the United States to get healthcare. And so these companies know that. And so how much do they suppress innovative changes in healthcare so they can keep making money on the current situation?
I'm not sure if much. I don't have evidence in terms of suppression, but I can say that if you look at around the world at providers in particularly developed countries, there is a sense of fear or misgiving about the idea of people traveling internationally. A fascinating article was written by a group of Australian cosmetic surgeons. And what they stated was that people that are traveling to Thailand, they had seen a number of them coming back after having received cosmetic surgery in Thailand, the country they picked on there in Australia. And they said that a number of them were coming back and having issues or problems, and therefore they were having to fix those issues and problems. Well, as anybody who's taken any number of graduate statistics classes can say, can point out, this is the problem, is it's not just the numerator, it's the denominator as well. What they're not saying is how many thousands of people traveled versus the, let's say they had saw five people that had problems or issues. What if there was 5,000 people that had traveled to from Australia to Thailand for cosmetic surgery? Well, then it would make the incidence of problems relatively rare. In fact, that percentage may be below the number of incidents that they have in Australia. The problem is the Australian cosmetic surgeons don't know the denominator. They don't know how many people are traveling. So therefore, in their experience, and obviously based on their fear of losing market share, they would say, oh my gosh, we're seeing problems coming back. But you see problems from domestic medical tourism or domestic cosmetic surgery patients. So what we see is obviously large groups, for example, in the United States, you see the American Hospital Association or the American Medical Association or other groups that will put out statements around be careful when you travel abroad because you don't know what you're going to get. We saw here in Texas an attempt by the physicians within Texas to try to limit or try to discourage people from doing telemedicine until they had actually talked to a Texas-based physician. And all these are well-intentioned. In other words, they're intending to try and help their patients. But I suspect that a part of that is they also realize that, you know, healthcare is becoming global.
Well, isn't it? I mean, let's face it, healthcare is a business just like any other business. They need to make money. Sure, there are many, many. My sister's a doctor, and she's very ethical. I think she's probably the most ethical doctor you're going to get. She just takes care of people, doesn't, I don't even know, she doesn't even think about the money, right? But a lot of doctors do. They have to stay competitive, and they need to feed their families, and there's regulation, and it's expensive, and all these things. And so they get caught into the same trap that all other businesses do, where they tend to just look at the bottom line. And when that environment happens, you're going to get competitive-type pressures. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with competition. I think competition can be great. It's just when the government facilitates and helps that, and it hurts health, you know, people's health care. I think if there's an open competition, that's what really becomes great, because then people look for the highest quality health care. And when there's world, when you can go, if someone's going to die, if my child's going to die from cancer, I tell you, I'm looking for the place in the world that's the best, that has the best rates of curing that type of cancer in the world, and I'm going there. I'm going to figure it out, because my child's not going to die.
You're exactly right, and this is the case for many medical tourist patients around the world, is they're looking for something that they want or need, and the internet and information on the internet allows them to search beyond just their local region or the local area to be able to look for, again, opportunities outside. And I agree. I think this is incredibly healthy. I think the trend of patient consumerism, of patients looking for information, is a very good thing. Now, there are scholars and analysts that are pointing out some weaknesses in that, particularly within healthcare, which is a different kind of product or service than what you would get, for example, when you're buying a car. Obviously, when you buy a car, you have global choices. You can buy a Korean car, you can buy a Japanese car, you can buy a German car, you can buy an American car, Italian. So you have choices of these different regions around the world. And even American cars may not be produced in the United States, but produced in Canada or produced in Mexico, or at least their parts and pieces are. But in healthcare, this is an interesting aspect. When it comes to going on the internet and looking for information about healthcare, which, by the way, is very prevalent, according to Pew Research, healthcare is one of the most the search for things on the internet. In fact, Pew suggested that other than basically social media and email is number one, social media was number two, that searching for healthcare is probably the third most common thing that people do on the internet. And then Google reports that 1 in 20 searches, so of all the things that people search for, 1 in 20 things are health or wellness or related. So like Groupon, a Groupon had done an analysis of the Groupon coupons that are available, and they found out that a majority of Groupon coupons are health and wellness related.
Interesting. So are there services now that are available for people that want to go out of the country and get, you know, when there's such a big market forming, are there companies that are servicing these people that want to go out of the country and get a medical procedure done?
Yes, and this is a bit controversial. And one of the things is that when people are searching on the internet, which is the majority of the way that people do search for healthcare, and that's arguably, based on our surveys at least, the majority of the way that potential medical tourists search for information is to use the internet. There's been a couple academic studies that have done a pretty good job of looking at information on the internet over the last couple of years, and what they found is, unfortunately, that the majority of the information that's out there is unfortunately either out of date or incorrect, and that's because there's a lot of sources that are not, for example, when you're searching for healthcare, you'll find search information that will come from the Cleveland Clinic or the Mayo Clinic, and you say, okay, I can trust that, but then you have other, or even perhaps in WebMD, sorry, WebMD or other sources. But then there's blog sites, there's small organizations, there's organizations that don't keep their information updated. So there's a variety of sources where the information may or may not be as good as what you need. So the Google is probably, or searching for it is probably one of the major ways. Now, there's organizations that purport to help you to find this, and there are groups of businesses called facilitators that will work with you, and then there's also the hospitals and the physicians or the providers themselves that will pose themselves or have information available on the internet to help you to choose healthcare providers. The difficulty with that is that if you're going to a hospital or a provider, obviously they have some stake in you going there. So obviously they're going to market themselves to you in a way that they would be perceived as a good place to go to when it may not be the right place for you. And then if you use a facilitator, there's very little regulations. It's kind of a wild and woolly business model. You could have a facilitator in India that may or may not have a health background. They may or may not have any technical knowledge. They may just be a, for lack of a better term, a glorified travel agent.
It's a black market almost. It's like how they get wives and what do you call it? Organ donors and slaves. They do that whole thing that way. And I suppose it's the same thing. It's unregulated. It can. I'm not saying it's bad necessarily. It's just an unregulated market.
Yeah, and it's obviously a very the modern iteration of medical tourism is a relatively new and innovative market. Although it's been around, medical tourism has been around since the beginning of time. When I was in Egypt, I saw up on the walls of one of the temples, I saw the formulary that some of the ancient priests used to use 2,000 or 3,000 BC that they were actually using with medical tourism patients from all around the world in places like Switzerland and Turkey. I've seen some of the ancient thermal spas that were there that the Romans used to use. So
it's just common sense, though, right? I mean, for people to want the best place for the situation or for the, you know, the issue that they have.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, it just
right.
seems common sense. Well, and with cosmetic surgery, for example, the South American countries, from what I understand, are way ahead of the game when it comes to cosmetic surgery. And even a lot of the Asian countries are diving into a lot of the equipment for that, and they're way ahead on that stuff compared to the United States. And I was doing some research on this just because of, you know, this topic, and I noticed that in Brazil and some of these other countries, they have hospitals that are offering cosmetic surgeries for, you know, where you get the hospital stay. It's a whole package, and the whole package with flight and the surgery and staying in a hotel for a couple weeks is like half the price of what it is here, and they've been doing it a lot longer.
That's correct. The what you'll find in general, now this is not always the case, but in general, you'll tend to find that a lot of the medical travel tends to be focused on what they call in healthcare the centers of excellence, the places that are well known for particular types of procedures. We very rarely see a general hospital, just a hospital that tends to be good, but not necessarily great in anything, that tends to be a destination for these medical travelers. Usually people are choosing to go someplace because of their reputation, because they have a good word of mouth, because they are listed on a valid or reliable, based on the consumer, list of providers or facilities that they should go to. You see certain locations or regions that get to be known for certain types of providers. As you pointed out, in Brazil or Colombia or South Korea for things like cosmetic tourism, there's some really fascinating ones. For example, when it comes to gender change or sex change operations, you have certain places in the world that have become known for those types of surgeries, and a lot of it, the centers of excellence and this gender change, the reputation is because of repetition. It turns out repetition among healthcare providers, just like athletes or just like pretty much any other job where you practice often, tends to be the main indicator of quality and good outcomes. I had actually a Yale professor that attended one of my conferences and gave me this fascinating story about sex or gender change. Very controversial, but an interesting story. And it was talking specifically about the country of Iran. Three countries, Thailand, Cuba, and Iran, are actually some of the leading places for gender change surgery.
Really? That's kind of interesting. I wouldn't have guessed that, but go ahead.
Yes, the story is fascinating. If you remember a few years back, the former president of Iran, Ahmadinejad, came to the United States. He spoke at the UN up in New York, and then he was invited to a university, and as I recall, it was NYU. And the president of NYU asked him some questions. One of the questions they asked of him, which led to some uncomfortable laughter and rumbling within the crowd, was the president asked him a question, how are gay and lesbian people treated in Iran? The president at that time, the former president of Iran, said, there are no gay and lesbian people in Iran, to which the uncomfortable laughter happened, which everybody knew to mean is if you're gay and lesbian under Sharia law, you would be stoned and put to death. And so it was a very uncomfortable subject to talk about that. In Iran, it's known that what you can do is if you are having gay or lesbian feelings, what you can do is get a gender reassignment surgery, and therefore you are not running afoul of Sharia law. So this gives an opportunity.
You were just born into the wrong body, and so they let you, they solve it that way. It kind of makes sense, actually.
Which is very, if you think about it, very trending in terms of the Caitlyn Jenner stories and things that are going around. So Iran, because the physicians have done these practices very often, they're actually known as being some of the best providers in the world for this particular surgery. And so people travel to Iran for this particular surgery. And that some people find that very striking because they're familiar with the very orthodox religious views of Iran. But actually, the physicians that practice this particular surgery are extraordinarily good at it.
That's interesting. So the pillars of excellence is really where things are starting to form based on where are the hotbeds, where are the best places in the world for different things, and that's where you're seeing. And it makes sense. Medicine is so complicated and so huge that, you know, our country's not going to be the best in everything. It's just not possible. When there's people all over the world that are just as capable and smart as we are, and when it comes to such a complex topic, you're going to have centers of excellence all over the world, you know, if they have the resources to do it.
That's correct. And then there's all sorts of wonderful, controversial sub-areas, such as deaf tourism in Switzerland. There was a case of a British family, a British wife, who went with her husband, who had a terminal illness, I assume cancer, that went to Switzerland for deaf tourism, which is doctor-assisted suicide. And when she got back, she was being charged by the British officials with killing her husband. That's because she did the planning and the booking of the flight and the booking of all the logistics in Great Britain, in England, where it's illegal to have doctor-assisted suicide, but in Switzerland it is legal. Now, obviously, the case didn't—they didn't pursue the case because no jury in the world would have found a woman grieving from taking her husband to Switzerland to get to die of his own will, of his own wishes. Would be found guilty. We had a similar case here in the United States, which made the cover of, I forgot, either Us or People magazine, Brittany Maynard, as I recall her name, a young lady who was, again, dying of cancer, who decided to move up to Oregon, which has doctor-assisted suicide. And so she became a resident of Oregon in order to be able to get access to that, to end her life the way she wanted to. And then we have wonderfully just fascinating cases such as some activists that have parked a boat off-site of Ireland in international waters. And what they did is shuttled women from Ireland. Ireland is a Catholic nation, predominantly Catholic, and so many of the laws are restrictive of abortion. So you had women shuttling out to international waters for abortions. That same group, as I recall, was involved in recently flying a drone, offering abortion drugs to women in Poland, again, a predominantly Catholic nation that was wanting access to these particular drugs. You have cases of fertility tourism where people are traveling to particularly developing countries to get access to having either fertility treatments or having surrogates in those countries that will have your babies. A fascinating case was an Australian couple, just happened not too recently, had gone to, as I recall, it was India or Thailand, I apologize, I don't remember where, but they had had, what they did is typical in surrogacy tourism. They had implanted more than one fetus in the, or gamut, I think it was called, into the surrogate. And two children were born. One was had Down syndrome. The other did not have Down syndrome. And so it was what would be considered a normal child. And that's, I know that wouldn't be a
sure. It's not necessarily politically correct.
But the couple show up in the country and they find out that one of the children has Down syndrome, and they decided not to take that child back to them, with them to Australia. It's a fascinating case. So here you have an Australian couple, and so biologically it's the child is Australian, but it was born of a international surrogate. The international surrogate then was left with the child and its upkeep, and the child has special needs. So therefore, the child had to, surrogate mother actually applied for Australian aid to help with the child and to try and get temporary citizenship, or at least citizenship in Australia.
So interesting. Because would be an Australian citizen. That's too bad that the parents abandoned their baby. That's awful.
And this is, obviously, this is one of the things that I see, and these things happen almost on a daily, weekly, or monthly basis, is that we have some fascinating aspect of this patient consumerism, of the growing globalization of healthcare. A Harvard Law professor, Glenn Cohen, likes to categorize it in terms of things that are legal in your country and things that are illegal in your country. And so we see the ability of people to cross borders, to have access to things that are not necessarily legal in your country, but legal somewhere else. And it's just every day, every year, I see something new that I hadn't expected to see before as I'm doing this research.
Well, how do you foresee the United States dealing with some of those legal issues? Do you see them not going after people that go get, if a surgery is illegal here, or access, you know, certain medication is illegal here, do you foresee them allowing people to go out of the country and get that? Or do you foresee the United States starting to crack down on that and saying, it's illegal here, if you're a U.S. citizen, you can't do it?
Well, there's only two real things that you can be found, possibly three if you include treason. There's two things that legally you can't do abroad. And one is you can't accept bribes abroad. That would actually be a crime that you can be tried for in the United States. You also can't engage in child prostitution. That's something that if you come back to the United States and there's evidence of that, they can try you in the United States. But other things, for example, if you were to commit murder abroad, so if you were to go to a foreign country and commit murder there, you would be tried in that foreign country. The sovereign aspects of the legal system prevent the U.S. Legal system from going after you in that respect.
So if so, you, but they would deport you for, you know, murder or something like that. In most cases, right? If it's a major crime.
Depends on the country and whether or not we have obligations or treaties signed with that country for the deportation.
Oh, wow. So you could go into some country we don't have a treaty with, kill somebody, and come back, and you're fine. That's awful.
You can also do
organ trafficking and all sorts of other things then, and then you're immune here.
That's correct. And there is rumors, for example, in places like Pakistan or China of people going to those countries for organ donations. Many countries around the world limit the availability of organ transplants to only their citizens because they don't want people coming in and accessing the gray or black market sales of organs. But Pakistan, as I recall, still doesn't have a moratorium or a law on the books that limits it to only its citizens. And in China, the rumor is, I don't have any data to verify that, but the rumor is that they have some of the largest organ banks in the world that people can get access to.
And that's from illegal supply, the rumor-wise?
Rumor-wise, it's suggested that when prisoners or even potentially political prisoners are killed, that they harvest their organs. Now, that could be conspiracy theories. It could be partially the truth. It would be a rational or logical thing to do with people that were put to death. Obviously, there's ethical, moral, and potentially legal dilemmas regarding the accessing of prisoners' organs, but arguably it would be a use of the organs. I heard about a Latin country, as I recall, was Panama, but don't quote me on it, that supposedly if you become a motorcycle rider, that as part of getting a license to ride a motorcycle, you also have to automatically sign up to be an organ donor.
I kind of like that. If you're going to do something stupid and you're going to die anyways, then you need to use your organs to benefit the rest of society. And I kind of see that too, where China could make that decision. If we're going to kill these people anyways, let's use their organs. The problem is, let's start killing a lot more people. You know what I mean? That's what the problem is.
It's a fascinating issue, but the motorcycle license, what they jokingly call them is they call motorcycles organ cycles in this country, and I apologize. I think it was Panama, I don't remember.
Yeah, that's a really dark issue, the whole black market on organs. But so there's just a lot of issues here, and as we become more sophisticated with healthcare, there's just going to be more and more of this. What age groups are, what kinds of groups of people are you seeing that are more apt to leave the U.S. to seek treatment? Age groups, education level, et cetera?
Great question. It's hard to generalize because, as we pointed out, it depends on the procedure. The type of person that is seeking fertility tourism is quite different than the person seeking dental tourism. It's quite different than the person going abroad for a spa-like procedure, different than the person going for a gastric bypass versus a hip replacement versus deaf tourism. So you can see the very different types of travel that are involved. And then again, you have, domestic versus international. So in general, there tends to be a bimodal distribution when it comes to that. That means two humps. And one of the humps tends to be people that are lower on the socioeconomic status. So what we see is travel, say, for example, in Africa or in Asia, particularly among people that don't have a lot of money or don't have a lot of opportunities to get good health care in the particular area they're in, leaving that area, in other words, they put together whatever money that they can and leaving that area to get better access to health care for themselves and their families. So we tend to have the lower socioeconomic status people, and you could think of that here in the American Southwest, particularly among Hispanics that travel across the border into Mexico. These could be either legal or illegal immigrants in the U.S. that are traveling to get access to health care in Mexico because they can afford to, where they can't afford to in the U.S. So that's one particular group. And then the other group is obviously the people that are of some affluence. They have the ability to travel, or they're already traveling, and therefore they're going to receive some treatment while they're traveling.
Yeah, for like cosmetic surgery or something. They're already going to France, so they're just going to get this done while they're there.
Right. And so there's people that, obviously, there's an old academic study in economics, as I recall, called Broken Leg Queues, where they asked economics professors to find out, to pick among two people who would potentially go to the movies. And what they found was it didn't matter if the person had the broken leg. That wasn't the most important question. The important question was whether they had the ability to afford to go to the movies. So people that can afford to receive the best treatment they can, the best quality treatment that they can afford abroad, would probably be the people that would be more likely to travel. Now, also, these people tend to, it's kind of a correlation, these people tend to be more educated, they tend to have more access to broadband internet, so therefore they have more access to information. So it just kind of makes sense that these people, the very poor that are seeking some alternative and the very affluent or educated or knowledgeable people that are tending to look for better quality care wherever they can find it.
Now, so do people come into this country for any reasons? Like, I was reading a thing on having babies, for example, people from China coming in to have babies. Are there other, you know, what do people come to this country for?
Oh, yes. The U.S. is definitely a major destination among the world for medical care. We have arguably some of the best facilities in the world. A former senator for the U.S. that was up for working in the federal government, particularly under the Obama administration, to roll out Obamacare, but wasn't able to because of tax issues. He made a recommendation that said that the U.S. Is islands of excellence among a sea of mediocrity, is how he stated it. And what he was saying was that there are some centers of excellence here in the United States, places that
well,
many
of course.
Us know.
Yes.
Cleveland, the Mayo Clinic, the MD Anderson, there's places that are known here in the United States. And we have a great deal of international visitors that come to places like Miami and Houston and New York and Baltimore and Cleveland and Los Angeles for health care. We also, here where I'm located in San Antonio, Texas, we have a hospital that receives a fair number of international visitors, particularly from northern Mexico, that come in here. So we're actually a fairly major destination, a major player. And in fact, interestingly, the Obama administration has recognized this. They helped put together a grant that was hundreds of thousands of dollars that was given to some researchers from a university out of Chicago that were looking at international travel into the United States. And also, as I recall, it was a vice president of international travel or something of that nature from John Hopkins that was put on the International Tourism Advisory Board to help advise the U.S. policy on international travel. So the Obama administration is very well aware of it.
Interesting.
Now,
go ahead.
Yeah, they're having babies, so I'd really like to address this. This is fascinating. So it's well known, and it's been well known for many years, that people travel into the United States, particularly from Mexico, to have babies here in the United States. There's many articles written about that. There's even a term for those babies, which is called anchor babies, which is babies that are born in the U.S., so they get U.S. citizenship, even though their parents are not U.S. citizens or may not be U.S. citizens. And so, therefore, it gives the people an opportunity to come into the United States later at some point in time and potentially get access to citizenship as their child lives here. So there's a variety of ways to do that. It could be as part of making an investment in a business here, and then you already have a child that's a citizen. There's a variety of different paths. But anyways,
use it for that to get citizenship. A lot of different.
Of course.
So in your mission statement, you talk about your organization as a nonprofit focused on the truth and motivated to provide key stakeholders with facts around this issue. I have two questions around that. I want to know who you think the key stakeholders are, and then what behaviors do you believe this will trigger amongst them by giving them all these facts?
That's a great question. I think obviously we can look at society and the community at large, obviously through radio programs such as what you do, by getting the truth, information about medical travel and the good, the bad, and the ugly about medical travel out to everyday people so that they understand, you know, the buyer beware, the caveat that they should know. I think that's very important. But also, it's very important from a regulatory and policy standpoint, a legal, a ethical, a moral standpoint for the stakeholders that are involved in government or in policy regulatory types of organizations, or even you think about you know, the UN or the World Health Organization, other types of entities. And then we also try to help develop information that will be useful for the healthcare providers, the healthcare facilities, the healthcare system in general. So we're trying to create a place where academics can get together and talk about academic issues, do peer research on the issue of patient consumerism and health-seeking behaviors among people. You know,
well, it's better not to have your head in the sand, right? If you're going to be managing things and looking at policies and strategies, you want to know the reality, what's really going on, even if it's ugly and you don't really want to hear it. You need to know what's really going on to make the right decisions, or good decisions, I should say right.
So around, for example, the anchor babies, as you had pointed out, what was fascinating is although we've had Hispanic anchor baby, this trend of Hispanic anchor babies, particularly from Mexico and other countries in Latin America, coming to the United States and have birthing procedures or birth tourism going on in the United States for years and years, we had a case recently of federal authorities cracking down on organizations that were engaging in birth tourism from China. So it was pregnant Chinese women that were hiding their pregnancies because the airlines don't allow you or would not like to prevent you from traveling, particularly in your ninth month, because that would be a bad time to have a baby while you're on an airline flight of 20 hours, you know, from Beijing to the United States. So they try to avoid that. So they would have, the organization would give women the instructions to hide their pregnancy by wearing large clothing that made them look like they were overweight rather than pregnant. Then they got to the United States and they packaged together trips to Disneyland, trips to shooting ranges, you know, trips to the beach, things like that that the Chinese mothers would want to do while they're here. And then they would have their babies in California hospitals. The women would have to make arrangements for them themselves. Obviously, a hospital would not be able to turn away a woman that had just broken her water and was coming in to have a baby. So the hospital would have to either eat that, or they would have to try to arrange to get payment from the woman at some later date, which would be up to the woman to do. But anyways, the birth tourism from China, what was fascinating is the federal authorities cracked down on this for a variety of reasons. But the funny thing is that they have been turning. I've never heard of federal authorities going after Hispanics coming into the United States. So yeah, I was surprised when I saw the news that there wasn't calls of, is this racism around Asians, when you have federal authorities cracking down on birth tourism from China, but you don't have the calls of racism, you know, where you don't have any crackdown on Hispanics coming into the United States, which is fascinating to me.
It's weird, yeah. So do you see, based on all this information that you're providing, do you see any backlash or resistance for you sharing it in the public? Have you felt any of that?
Yes, a little bit. There's organizations, particularly in the medical tourism industry, which has grown up over the past 10 years or so, that are interested in promoting medical tourism because they believe that it is a good thing overall. And although I'm a business professor, so as you pointed out earlier, I believe that healthcare is a business. I know that that's not always a popular stance among particularly people that have been in healthcare for many years, people that perhaps have a public health view of healthcare. But quite frankly, healthcare is a business, and to look at it any other way would be, quite frankly, illogical. So if you look at it as a business, there's good aspects and bad aspects. There's ugly aspects of any business. There's unethical, immoral, illegal types of things that go on, things that you look at and you say, yeah, I don't think that's probably good. So I think there's, you know, people that say medical tourism is bad, and there's people that say medical tourism is good. And my belief is that neither of them are completely right, that there's a little bit of good and bad and ugly in all of it. And as you know, you've heard some of these wonderful stories about some of the controversial things that are going on around the world in healthcare. It's part of the nuance of a global competitive business that is becoming healthcare.
There can be some really positive by having competition, but then again, it can cause a lot of negatives too. It's kind of like capitalism really works. It's really good as long as you make it work. You know what I mean? There's so many negatives with capitalism, but it's kind of the best of the worst. That's how I see it. And the government's there to help make it work, you know, but not screw it up.
Yes, and a perfect example of that is, I do have to say a little controversial thing. I think that the rest of the world has quite frankly seized upon, and by the rest of the world, I mean many countries around the world, has seized upon capitalism in healthcare more so than the United States. There are many political in the United States that seem to be anti-capitalistic in terms of healthcare, whereas we've seen a rapid expansion of healthcare in places like India. Now, let's be fair, India has a strong need for more healthcare, but what we've seen is the government do things like, for example, tax holidays to make it easy from a regulatory standpoint for healthcare innovation and healthcare investments and facilities to prop up in India. There was a example given on the Wharton School of Business site that showed a Indian hospital breaking even in two and a half years in India, which would be unheard of in the United States.
Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah. Well, a lot of the United States hospital systems are really struggling financially, from what I understand.
And a lot of that is due to lower reimbursement rates because of the expansion of things like, first of all, the growing aging population in the United States, which means more Medicare, and then the expansion of Medicaid, and then the increase of the PPACA, ACA, Obamacare plans. And so what we're seeing is kind of continuing pressure on lower reimbursements. And so the U.S. hospitals, I've been approached by many hospitals all across the nation and by government officials and states and regions and cities that I've been working with that are trying to become medical tourism destinations. And the reason is because a medical tourist is a much more valuable type of tourist than a regular tourist. And the facilities, the hospitals, the medical, the health wellness facilities that see these medical tourists, these tourists tend to pay higher premiums. They tend to pay either out of pocket or with private health insurance. And those premiums, those reimbursements are higher margin. So this seems to be the competitive response to the growing lowered or growing pressure on lower reimbursements in the United States.
Well, if you look at LASIK surgery, that's a great example of being an open market because it's not really covered by insurance and things. And so it was a free market kind of thing, and the price has gone way down and the quality has gone way up.
I agree. And my bias is I will acknowledge that I am a business professor, and so therefore I believe in the power of capitalism and free markets. I don't believe that they're perfect, but as you stated,
they're not perfect, for sure.
It's better than everything else. And in India and other countries around the world, we've seen a rapid expansion of healthcare competence, healthcare utilization, healthcare facilities. the educational healthcare providers, and a lot of that is because of the both the globalization and also the free market response to patient consumerism. And I think it's a good thing. In the United States, it's estimated that by 2018, the percentage of GDP that is used for healthcare-related expenses, services, and procedures will be upwards of 18 to 20%. In other words, you know, it's going to be one-fifth of the economy here very soon. And so that means that one out of every $5 spent in the
That's a lot. I hope it's not one out of five of every one of my dollars. I sure have other things to spend my money on.
No, but it's we're seeing demographics head in the wrong direction if you want to decrease cost in healthcare, because we're seeing around the world, not just in the United States, there's countries like Germany and Japan that are much worse off than we are, but we're seeing growing aging populations around the world. We're seeing the increase of the number of super centenarians, people that are born after the 1800s. There's people still around. And what's going to happen is it's now estimated that most people that that if you have a couple that retire at the age of 65, that one or both of them will probably live to be 90. Fidelity, I think, recently suggested that it would be almost $250,000 out of pocket for a couple to retire in terms of healthcare expenses. $250,000 of out of pocket healthcare expenses, not including what Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, all those things are covering, but out of pocket expenses. We have 10,000 baby boomers a day turning 65 in this country. We're heading towards a perfect storm of increasing healthcare utilization because of an aging population, also an increasing rates of obesity and overweight. Already
in the majority,
a majority of Americans.
And increased cancer rates.
Actually, cancer correlates with obesity and being overweight, and also with aging, as does cardiac problems, as does orthopedic problems. We're going to see the whole gamut of healthcare utilization increasing at a time when the majority of the healthcare professionals are baby boomers, so they are retiring, and we're not turning out enough STEM students, in other words, students that are focused on engineering.
Go ahead.
So we're not seeing enough healthcare providers coming out of colleges and universities to fill the future needs of this country or hardly any other country around the world. So what's happening is healthcare is going up. The utilization of healthcare is going up. We're having a decreasing number of providers, and we're arguably because of our affluence. And by the way, this is not just the United States. You're seeing increasing obesity rates in places like China. You're seeing incidence of diabetes. The number one country in the world for number of total cases is probably India. You're seeing increasing rates of healthcare problems in places like Africa, where they have a population of a billion people on that continent, and it's all because of affluence. As we get more money, we have the ability to drive cars rather than walk and bicycle. We have the ability to sit down in front of a television or a PlayStation. We have more professional jobs because of higher incidence of education, because we tend to get more educated. We eat more food because we have more of
But, you know, here's a positive. I did a show on matching your DNA to the foods that match, you know, match your foods to your DNA so that you get the proper nutrients that your body needs. And that's affluence we could, as people are aging, if you're getting the right nutrients on a daily basis that matches your DNA, there's going to be a lot less illnesses. So there are some things that we can do.
Agreed. The major problem, as you're aware, is not just the nutrient foods. It's the amount of calories and the amount of...
But you got to have a little bit of positive pumped into all the picture that I mean, it's the obesity rates. If you go to... I went to France last year, and I couldn't believe how much heavier we are here. So there aren't it's not everywhere. And that's what's interesting, is that obesity is not a problem everywhere. So that's another thing. Why is it a problem here? You know, why isn't it a problem in France? You know, what are we doing? Go ahead.
Well, a couple of interesting things. And in terms of, I'll make it short, but in terms of the U.S. versus other destinations, the interesting aspect. So if you compare the U.S. healthcare system versus a place like Japan or Switzerland or some of these other countries that OECD always says, oh, they're much better than the United States, there's some differences, and they're ones that we have to consider. If you look at the incidence of car injuries and deaths in Japan or Switzerland compared to the United States, what would you think the difference would be?
They're huge.
We have a lot more here.
So you're saying it's our lifestyle.
I live here in Texas. I can't go anywhere. I can't go to a grocery without driving 10 to 15 miles somewhere. And the United States is one of those countries that, although it is increasing in its urbanization, there's still large rural environments and suburban environments. And let's be honest, in the United States, the majority of people need cars in order to get somewhere, and car injuries and car deaths are much larger here than they are in Japan or Switzerland. How about this? You ready for this? This is fascinating. Does Japan or Switzerland, do they have a border? Do they share a 100-mile border, 100-plus-mile long border with a obviously developing or third world country? And the answer is no, they don't. Switzerland doesn't share a border with a country like Mexico. Mexico, which, by the way, is also considered one of the fattest countries in the world, if not the fattest country in the world.
They're kind of in line with us.
In terms of obesity and overweight ratio of their population. So
that's one thing we don't want to win.
Exactly right. And then obviously we have a wonderful foodie culture that has been growing over the years, and we love food in the United States, and we have a lot of access to food, and arguably we have a lot of access to cheap food. Having access to
cheap food without nutritional value.
Exactly right. What's happened is a couple of years back, we went past the tipping point where nutritious foods actually cost more. For example, organic or locally grown foods or foods that are more nutritious actually cost more than a cost-effective, non-nutritious food would be that you can get access much cheaper that's manufactured or produced based on particles or pieces.
Exactly. Like ho-hos are very cheap. But, you know, a ho-ho is a lot less expensive than buying a nice apple or a tomato at the store.
Exactly right. So what's happened is we have developed a culture here in the United States that is probably not as positive towards healthcare. And then we also have the aging population on top of that. So some of it is not just that the U.S. system is bad, it's that there are specific elements of our demographics and our population and our location, our geography. And then one final one. This is fascinating, by the way. Did you know that diversity is not necessarily good when it comes to healthcare? And what I mean by that is it turns out that doctors, for example, in Japan, where most of the people that they deal with are genetically very similar in nature, it's much easier for the doctor to make a diagnosis and be able to treat because their population is very similar.
That makes sense. Although, mix, if you have a child with very different genetics, you know, a parent with different genetics, aren't the child healthier?
Well, what happens is, if you think about from a population health standpoint, there are, say, groups of Orthodox Jewish people that have very specific diseases that are more common because of their genetics than there are in, for example,
sure. Hispanic. So it's easier to serve a population if there isn't a lot of variances. However, if you have children with two people have a lot of variation in genetics, they have a child, that child tends to be healthier.
There you go. But the diversity of the population makes it difficult for a provider to be able to So what happens is in Switzerland or Japan, you don't see as much diversity of the population because they don't have as diverse of a mix. So it's fascinating, but the
well,
actually
plus the, the physician needs to just be that much more aware, and it's harder.
Exactly right. So if you look at the infrastructure aspects, demographic, location, geography, it's arguable to say that the U.S. is doing a pretty fair job from an outcome standpoint. Is there room for improvement? Definitely. But could you say that the healthcare system is good or perhaps as good as Japan and Switzerland without those other pieces? Yeah, we'd probably from an outcome standpoint would look like one of the top countries in the world. Now, there's one other aspect that you touched on, which is the kind of controversy regarding the growth of medical tourism. And that is, what are we going to do in the United States to try to prevent this? What are we going to do to combat against this? And I don't know what the answer is. I think that it's here to stay. I think it's growing. I think that it's going to continue to be a major force in healthcare. And I think, quite frankly, that this is the new normal, is that people are becoming more of consumers when it comes to healthcare, and
well,
I think
that could be good because it could force our to get our act together as far as, because let's face it, the cost of healthcare is the most expensive in the world here, and so we have issues. We have a system issue, right? I mean, how we manage it is just a mess, and then we also don't allow innovations to come in that easily. So we do need some competition to fix those problems, because we're not going to just fix it, because it hasn't happened yet. So we have to have some way to force them to fix some of these issues that are very serious.
That's true. And I think that you are correct in saying that this having international providers taking a portion of the market share of the U.S. population, having specific cases like wealthy athletes traveling international, having situations, for example, Ascension Health, this is a very controversial aspect of what Ascension Health is, a large nonprofit Catholic healthcare system, the largest Catholic healthcare system in the United States, as I recall. They invested in a facility in the Caribbean with an Indian provider. At the time, the CEO of the Ascension Health stated that this was not a medical tourism play, that instead this was an attempt to provide good, high-quality health care in the Caribbean, in the Bahamas, as I recall.
Sure.
The interesting aspect is, though, quite frankly, this is an investment in a higher reimbursement rate, because most of the people that are going to be going to that facility are going to be affluent if they're in the Caribbean, or they're going to be affluent Americans that are traveling down there to get access to procedures or to care that may be either cheaper or not accessible in the United States. And so, regardless of how it's framed, or the truth is, this is a It's almost like Ascension is acting like a for-profit organization and investing in a better situation by putting a facility internationally. So that may be one of the plays, is you may see the U.S. Facilities increasingly investing in international healthcare in order to diversify their revenue stream and seek higher reimbursement rates.
And they have to. People are driven by natural human things. And so it's just natural for them to be doing that kind of stuff, and it all leads back to, well, you're a business professor, and I also teach at the Carlson School of Management at the U of M, and so I tend to think business wise too, and so it's just the natural behavior of people. That's what they're going to do. Then you have people like my sister, who is an actual is the doctor. She just wants to give really great health care, but the administrators who are dealing with the numbers issues, they and if they're struggling, the normal, healthy, natural behaviors to figure out ways for them to be a healthier unit. And that's to make more money so that they can provide for their families and for their well-being.
Absolutely. Well, I think it's, again, I think it's going to continue to happen. I don't see it slowing down. In fact, I see it potentially exponentially growing over time. I think what you're going to find is that this is the new normal in healthcare, and that people are going to increasingly engage in patient consumerism, particularly as the millennials become a larger portion of the population, not just the United States, but abroad. It's expected within the next decade that they'll make up 76% of the total working population in the United States. So therefore, the millennials, the interesting, you remember we talked about the Pew Research and people searching the internet for healthcare. It turns out that people that use mobile devices are even more likely to search for healthcare information than those people that are sitting down in front of a desktop or a computer or a laptop. So therefore, the millennials, if you think about it, as soon as they hear about a friend or a family member's diagnosis for cancer, a specific type of cancer, what are they going to do?
Well, they're much more open to using all that stuff.
They're going to whip out their smartphone and they're going to search for information on it, and they're going to start searching for different alternatives. They're going to say, yeah, you know, this is the way that they've been treating it since the 1980s, but is there another way? Is there something new out there? Is there something different out there? And if it happens to occur outside their area or region or even country, I think they'll be more willing perhaps than even previous generations to travel for that.
Well, where can people find more information about your organization and find more research? Because you have so much research that you've done and such great information. Where can people find this?
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. That's what we're hoping to do, is just continue to engage people in a debate about, again, the good, bad, negative, and ugly aspects of medical tourism. Again, I think it's an overall good trend, I guess. You can't put the genie back in the bottle, so it's going to happen.
But regardless, you're providing the information so that they can do what they want with it. It's here it is. Whether you agree with me or not, here's the information.
Yeah, and it's all based on data and information. We tend to be empirical in nature. Our website is medicaltourismresearch.org. It's called the Center for Medical Tourism Research. And again, I'm a business professor with the University of the Incarnate Word. It's a mid-sized Catholic university here in San Antonio, Texas. And I love researching this area. It's just so fascinating and so interesting. And I really, really appreciate your time and interest.
Okay, well, great. Well, thank you so much, and I'll have that information up on my radio page, and we'll go from there. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you. You too. And again, thank you and all your listeners for learning a little bit more about this fascinating area.
Of course.
Thank you.
So if you want to get hold of my guests for any reason or see more information that they may have, I will have their contact information and their web pages on my webpage at sarahwestall.com. And also be sure to go to my website and comment on some of these shows and let me know what you think about, let me know what you think about today's show. Or if you're listening to this on iTunes, please go in there and rate the show. It helps other people learn about where to find good content. So for now, everyone, have a wonderful day.